वासुदेवायाम्। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवायाम्। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवायाम्। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 13, Text Number 6. Kvachit vitoya sarta abhiyati cha alasate nirandha asadhya dabham kvachit agni tapta nividyate kva cha yakshai rita asuha. Kvachid vitoya sarito biyati parasparam chalasite nirandham asadhya davam kvachid agni tapto nividyate kvachayaksharitasu. Kvachid vitoya sarito biyati parasparam chalashate nirandham asadhya davam kvachid agni tapto nividyate kvachayakshartasu. Kvachid vitoya sarito biyati parasparam chalashate nirandham asadhya davam kvachid agni tapto nividyate kvachayaksharitasu. Let's chant. Ladies.
Thank you. Kvachid. Sometimes. Vittoyaha. Without depth to the water. Sarita. Rivers. Abiyati. He goes to bathe or jumps into. Parasparam. One another. Cha. And. Alashate. Desires. Nirandaha. Being with no stock of food. Asadhya. Experiencing. Davam. A forest fire in family life. Kvachit. Sometimes. Agni taptaha. Burned by fire. Nividyate. Is despondent. Kva. Somewhere. Cha. And. Yakshai. By kings resembling rogues and thieves. Rita. Taken away. Asu. Wealth. Which is as dear as one's life. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada ki. Sometimes the conditioned soul jumps into a shallow river, or being short of food grains, he goes to beg food from people who are not at all charitable. Sometimes he suffers from the burning heat of household life, which is like a forest fire. And sometimes he becomes sad to have his wealth, which is as dear as life, plundered by kings in the name of heavy income taxes. Purport. When one is hot due to the scorching sun, one sometimes jumps into a river to gain relief. However, if the river is almost dried up and the water is too shallow, one may break his bones by jumping in. The conditioned soul is always experiencing miserable conditions. Sometimes his efforts to get help from friends are exactly like jumping into a dry river. By such actions, he does not derive any benefit. He only breaks his bones. Sometimes, suffering from a shortage of food, one may go to a person who is neither able to give charity nor willing to do so. Sometimes one is stationed in household life, which is compared to a forest fire, samsara davanala lidha loka. When a man is heavily taxed by the government, he becomes very sad. Heavy taxation obliges one to hide his income. But despite this endeavor, the government agents are often so vigilant and strong that they take all the money anyway, and the conditioned soul becomes very aggrieved. Thus, people are trying to become happy within the material world. But this is like trying to be happy in a forest fire. No one need go to a forest to set it ablaze. Fire takes place automatically. Similarly, no one wants to be unhappy in family life or worldly life, but by the laws of nature, unhappiness and distress are forced upon everyone. To become dependent on another's maintenance is very degrading. Therefore, according to the Vedic system, everyone should live independently. Only the Shudras are unable to live independently. They are obliged to serve someone for maintenance. It is said in the Shastras, Kalo Shudra Sambhava. In this age of Kali, everyone is dependent on another's what? Mercy for the maintenance of the body. Therefore, everyone is classified as a Shudra. In the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that in Kali Yuga, the government will levy taxes without reciprocally benefiting the citizens. Anavrishtya varangshanti durbhiksha kara pidita. In this age, there will also be a shortage of rain. Therefore, a scarcity of food will arise, and the citizens will be very much harassed by government taxation. In this way, the citizens will abandon their attempts to lead a peaceful life and will leave their homes and hearths and go to the forest in sheer disappointment. Translation: sometimes the conditioned soul jumps into a shallow river, or being short of food grains, he goes to beg food from people who are not at all charitable. Sometimes he suffers from the burning heat of household life, which is like a forest fire. And sometimes he becomes sad to have his wealth, which is as dear as life, plundered by kings in the name of heavy income taxes. Omagina timirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshur unmilitam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances at his lotus feet. I pray for the blessings and mercy of all the assembled Vaishnavas and all who may be listening on the internet, for your blessings that I may say something useful and beneficial for everyone, including myself. For without the blessings and mercy of the Vaishnavas, what can I say of any value? So we have a very interesting description of the forest of material nature. This forest is very dark, and generally speaking, it has no paths. So wherever you walk, wherever you look, wherever you shout, you're still lost, because it's dark and there is no indication of how to get out of it. The only possibility of getting out is that one has to meet someone who knows the way out. He knows the trees, he knows the path, he knows which way to go, which will lead to the roadway and ultimately to his village or a town or a city. But otherwise, he's lost, he's trapped. So without the mercy of a spiritual master, one is trapped in this dark forest and will suffer all of the difficulties, the troubles, the problems, the tribulations that come when living in a dark forest in which one does not know how to get out or where to go. It's very interesting that in the Mahabharata, when the Pandavas moved into the home that Duryodhana had built for them in Varanavata, they knew already that there was that Parochana, who was the counselor and aide of Duryodhana, they knew that he was going to set the house ablaze at some time in the future. They didn't know exactly when, but they knew that that would happen. And they knew that they would have to find a way out of this particular difficult situation. So they spent much time walking through the forests, practically memorizing the trees there, because they would have to escape at night. Generally, that's the ideal time to set a fire, because nobody can see anything except the fire. So they knew they would have to go to the forest, and in the forest they would have to find their way somehow to the river. And at the river, they would either have to swim across, or hopefully there might be a boat there. Of course, later on we find out that Vidura, knowing exactly when the fire would be lit and informing the Pandavas through a miner, once they knew the date, then they lit the fire themselves, in which the whole place went up in flames, including Parochana, who had planned to murder all five Pandavas and Mother Kunti for no other reason than Duryodhana could hopefully become the next king. Because without the Pandavas, there was no legal way in which Duryodhana could become the next king. So when they entered the forest, they knew exactly which way to go to get to the Ganga, the Ganges River. Through the mercy, through the guidance, through the direction of Vidura, or Saint Vidura, as he Srila Prabhupada so affectionately refers to him. So similarly, persons are in this material world. It is called the material forest. But what is worse is that although persons are in this forest, they don't know that there is a fire all around them. For example, you may have good health today, good physical health, you have good mental health, good intellectual health, you go to school or you're out of school, you're successful in your business or successful in your schooling, and you're happy because you're succeeding. And you think that this is the way it's going to go on, not just today, but tomorrow and the day after and the day after. And my whole life will be happy physically, mentally, intellectually, emotionally. I'm not going to have a single problem because everything is going on well today and everything will go on well tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps into this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle, life is but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. I didn't make that up, that's Shakespeare. So, thought I'd throw that in. It really was appropriate. So, the old bard comes out with a few goodies once in a while. So anyway, getting to the point is that that's the way physical life or material life is. You think we'll all go on, and then one day you come down with swine flu. How did this come to me? I was healthy, I was strong, I was vigorous, I was agile. And now I'm laid up, and the doctors say I could die. It can come any time, any moment, any second. We can never be overconfident of our next step, our next breath. And that's what the material forest tends to do. You're sitting in the forest or you're doing whatever you can, but the fire is burning all around and it's getting closer and closer and closer. And until it finally singes your skin, you suddenly wake up and say, I'm sick, I can't think, my body is aching. Confirmed. My body is aching. I do have a little back problem today. So, my body is aching. My mind is becoming dulled. I can't remember things well. I get upset, emotionally disturbed over the slightest thing. If you drop a book on the floor, I say, what are you doing? Can't you hold on to your book? Everything is disturbing me. And intellectually, I try to figure out problems like I used to, and I can't do it today. What's going on? So everyone is thinking that it's going to go on neatly and nicely forever and ever. And yet, that's not the truth. And it's so interesting how the living entity or the soul deludes itself into the belief that, yes, I'm okay. Everything's going on okay. And although the fire is getting hotter, we deny it. We delude ourselves. Oh, okay, I got a little problem. My shoulder aches a little bit. Maybe my knees hurt a little bit. My ankles. But what's? It'll go away. And then sometimes it gets worse and worse. And then all we're doing is thinking about our little bodies as if the body is the end all and be all, as if there's nothing else. Run to this doctor, run to that doctor, this potion, this pill, this nostrum, this cure-all. Every which way we're going to try to get rid of the pain, the suffering, the distress, the trouble. This is what material life is like. Anyone who watches TV today will notice that the preponderance of the advertisements are what? Medicinal. Medicine for your cough. Medicine for your eyes, medicine for your ears, medicine for your memory, medicine for your hair. Yeah, they got stuff, rub it on and you can get more hair. medicine for your joints, Theraflu and this flu and that. And there's endless amounts of medicines. And so you're swirling around the medicinal cabinet. Your whole life is just take five of these this morning, five reds, three greens, six blues, eight oranges. A person has a bill at the end of the year of like $50,000 in just medical bills. And if he doesn't have Part D of the Medicare, he's really up the creek. Really. Who can pay those bills? If you have Medicare, they pay some of it. So, therefore, this verse, Judd Barrett is trying to wake up King Rahugana, who's in this, he's in this consciousness that everything will go on nice. I'm the king, I have sway, I have power, people look up to me, people glorify me, people know I'm superior to them. Judd Barrett is telling, that's not going to go on forever. There are six whips: hunger, thirst, grief, illusion, old age, and dying. And these will all afflict you at some point in time. And you'll become miserable. And you'll forget how superior you are. You'll forget all your glory because you'll be so wrapped up in just trying to preserve your life. That's all you'll be thinking about. Get this physician, call that physician. So he's saying, don't waste your life in this falseness, this illusion that you are important, that you are valuable, that you are great. Your greatness can only be viewed from the point of view of the Supreme Lord. To the degree that you speak well, to the degree that you manage well, to the degree that you think well, to those degrees, that is coming from the mercy of Krishna. That is God's mercy. For example, I'm speaking now. I could not say a word unless he allowed my tongue to move. Unless he allows my voice box to work. Unless he allows my mind to work. Unless he allows the speech to work the way it's supposed to. He could stop me from speaking in a moment. But I'm speaking because he's allowing me to. If I speak badly, it's because I'm not allowing him to. If I speak well, it's because his mercy is descending and somehow allowing, in spite of my defects, my faults, my failings, and the like. This is all his mercy. Any good that we manifest comes from him. Krishna says, I am the ability in man. Your ability is derived from me. But we see, what do we see in the world? Everybody is taking credit for what they do. The scientist, he gets his Nobel Prize. Yes, I worked hard. I did this. I did that. Not knowing that God, Krishna, has given him the intelligence to do what he did and has given him the karmic reaction to achieve the success that he has achieved. So he's thinking it was all due to my wonderful, steadfast, pertinacious endeavor. That's all it took. Just make your effort. Then he tells lots of other people, just stick with it, just do it, and you too can win a Nobel Prize. Not so. It's not just stick-to-itiveness. You also have to have the special mercy of God. The idea that if I just do the work, I will get the result that I want, is not necessarily true. You have to deserve it. Desire, yes, but deserve also. If you don't deserve it, then the Lord doesn't give it to you. If you do enough pious activities, that he may give it to you. So a devotee understands this principle and doesn't get caught up in the idea that if he does something beautiful or wonderful or glorious or amazing, that he should take his credit for it. Why? The only one amazing is Krishna. The only one great is Krishna. And to the degree, as I mentioned before, that he releases a little bit of that mercy into our brains or our minds or our bodies, to that degree we manifest something successful, something great, something wonderful. And if he releases less, then you're less wonderful, less great. So, therefore, it is even mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, four kinds of pious persons begin to render devotional service to me: the distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who was searching for knowledge of the absolute. Of these, the one who is in full knowledge and always engaged in pure devotional service is the best. For I am very dear to him, and he is dear to me. So, at the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may, as it's mentioned, four kinds of pious persons begin to render devotional service to me. The distressed person may have illness. He must have some difficulty, some problem in his body. And he prays to Krishna, please cure me. And Krishna cures him. So he gets a little faith. And from that faith, you know, he gets another illness. Krishna cures him. In fact, the whole Christianity started just that way. Jesus walked around and there were people who were blind, people who were deaf, people who had illnesses. And they said, Master, please cure me. And he would just stretch out and he says, do you have faith? And they said, yes, then your faith has cured you. He didn't take the credit for himself. He says, your faith in God has cured you. This is the symptom. This is the mark of a great soul. He doesn't like taking credit for himself because he knows that very special secret that I just mentioned, that God is the true doer in our life. And that we can beg the Lord to help us do what? To serve him beautifully. Now, two people can do the same job. One can do it for materialistic purpose. For example, let's just say I'm an athlete. And there was a very interesting movie some time ago that had just this theme. It's about two runners. And one of the runners, he was studying to be a Protestant minister. So somebody once asked him and said, well, why are you doing all this running? You're going to be a minister. You're going to preach from the pulpit. Why are you getting into these big running races? He says, well, I have a talent in running. And I want to express the glory of God through my running. So whatever greatness I have or whoever I beat is due to the mercy of God. This he said right on the big screen. Rarity. Not the same as Goodfellas or any of those other horrible movies. So this was his reply. This is his the other person who was his competitor. He happened to be of the Jewish faith, and he wanted to show the greatness of the Jewish people. So they were thinking beyond their own little bodies, especially the Protestant minister. So a devotee knows this. And he never takes the credit for himself. He knows that Krishna is so intelligent. If you look across the street and see these trees, how beautiful they are. The flowers, how beautiful. The sky and the cloud formations. The sunsets, the sunrises. Who can paint a picture as gorgeous, as glorious, as beautiful, as compelling as Krishna? We can only be just poor imitations. But if we see ourselves as that, then even that's wonderful if it is being recognized for what it is, namely the mercy of God. And when the mercy of God flows through us in the form of speech, in the form of talent, the form of ability, our business is to never, never want to accept this glory for ourselves. And when we no longer accept the glory for ourselves, we are free of the false ego, which is what keeps us in that forest with the fire burning around us till it finally singes our skin, singes our brain, our mind, and we are then full of troubles. So Krishna gives us a way out of the forest. Here's the way, right here. All we do is just read it. Feel when we read it that we are the most blessed person in the universe. Every page, every line, Sanskrit, English, every bit of it is just radiating, completely shining out its beauty of God's mercy. And we are simply to, just as we had that shower yesterday and the rain was pouring down, we have only to begin reading it, studying it, focusing on it, and the shower flows into us, around us, everywhere. And we then gain that mercy. And every day that we read it, and it encourages us to chant God's holy names. Hear this Bhagavatam. Associate with devotees. Worship the deities. All of these things are encouraged in this book. Prahlad Maharaj, he mentioned 9 particular kinds of devotional service. Hearing about the Lord, chanting about the Lord, serving the lotus feet of the Lord, worshiping the Lord, offering prayers to God, practical service to the Lord, surrendering one's body, mind, and words to the Lord. All this is the way out of this dark, treacherous, terrible forest. And if we take them seriously, what does it mean to take it seriously? It means that, if you're in an ocean and somebody throws you, and you're on the verge of drowning, somebody throws you a life raft, you clutch onto it with dear life. You hold it because you're serious about wanting to be rescued. It's not like you start playing games with the life raft or the what do they call that circular thing? Huh? Life raft? A lifesaver, yes. So, you don't play with it like you do when you're in the kiddie pool when you're a kid. You hold on to it with dear life, and then you're gradually pulled in slowly. And as you're pulled in and up onto the ship, you feel that you've gotten your life back. Similarly, these books, we should realize, they are true lifesavers. And they are rescuing us from the throes of birth, death, old age and disease, because a devotee who becomes filled with pure love of God, of Krishna, through loving devotional service, through associating with devotees, through reading these glorifiable books, that devotee, although his physical body will die, apparently like everybody else's, but everybody else will take another, who's not a devotee, will take another birth and forget all his accumulations, all his acquirements, all his trappings of material life. For example, I own $1 million. I'll forget that. I have a Cadillac or I have a Mercedes car. I'll forget that. And I start all over again as a child, as a baby. And as a baby, it's like you don't have anything anymore. You're totally forgetful. That's what real death is. You forget who you were in your previous life, and you don't even know who you are in this life because you never knew who you are, never found out who you are, never read this wonderful book or the Bhagavad Gita or all of the great books that Prabhupada has given us, which are being nicely distributed throughout. Consequently, persons, they just spin around and go from body to body. But a devotee who has been serving the Lord with his heart, his soul, his mind, his strength, his all, a devotee who serves in that manner, he doesn't go where everybody else goes. For him, as it is said in the scripture, there is no death because he ascends to the spiritual world. And even while he's in this world, his Satchit Ananda, that is his eternality, knowledge and bliss, absolute nature, has already manifested. So he ascends to the spiritual or eternal world to take up his service, just as he has been serving here in this material world. But in the material world, as I said, some people can serve. I was about to give the analogy of an athlete. So you have one athlete, he's trying to be a champ because he wants everyone to praise him, to glorify him, to think so highly of him. This is false ego. I'm great. I'm God. I'm wonderful. They don't come better than me. That's what everyone's begging and hoping for. But the devotee, he does it for the glory and pleasure of God. That's his only business. He doesn't care what he gets for himself, because he knows God is a loving God, a merciful God, a kind God, a sweet God, and that he will take care of the devotee as is necessary. The devotee is protected, and His things that he has are preserved. Those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and preserve what they have. To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give them the understanding by which they may come to me. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So Krishna is there. He's kind, he's merciful, he's loving. And to the degree that we offer our loving service to the deities, to Srila Prabhupada, to other devotees, and to mankind, womankind in general, Krishna sees that. He recognizes it. He applauds it. And he expresses his appreciation by sending his love into the soul of the devotee. And the devotee feels that love in the form of transcendental bliss and peace and knowledge. And when the devotee ascends, leaves this world, he leaves with that Sat-Chit Ananda, that eternality, bliss, knowledge and bliss absolute, and goes to the spiritual kingdom to continue his service to Krishna. It's not like it's all cut off at death. The only difference is that the devotee goes, he's in the same consciousness, but he goes to Krishna and the devotees of Krishna, and he's ever blissful. The only sadness there may be is if he doesn't see Krishna for a second. That's real love. You don't see Krishna for 10 minutes and the heart is beating. Where is Krishna? This was the mood of the Goswamis in Vrindavan. Where is Krishna? Madhavendra Puri. Although he was highly advanced and feeling the presence of Krishna all the time, he had seen Krishna a few times. And he was, at the final days, he was asking, where is Krishna? And of course, when he left his body, he saw Krishna. He was with Krishna. He said, oh my Lord, oh merciful Master, oh Master of Mathura, when shall I see you again? Because of my not seeing, my agitated heart has become so unsteady. O most beloved, what shall I do now? He was in a state of desperation, a state of complete anxiety, because he wanted to be with his beloved Lord. And this is what we all should be aspiring for, to be with our beloved Lord. And if we give our whole heart, as Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, do it for me. Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu must be performed, otherwise work causes bondage in this material world. If we give to the Lord as he asks us to do, not because he needs what we have to offer him, but we need to get rid of our false ego, our pride, our arrogance, our conceit, our vanity. And by giving, 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 actually it is a getting, 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 getting. You get from giving, giving without the desire to get something back. But because Krishna sees that that is a pure offering, he gives plenty back, more than we can ever imagine. So that is the mercy of the Lord. And that way, which I've just described, we have been given by our glorious, gracious, spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. He has given us the torchlight to get out of this samsara dava naladita loka. The spiritual master is receiving benediction from the ocean of mercy. Just as a cloud pours water on a forest fire to extinguish it, so the spiritual master delivers the materially afflicted world from the blazing fire of material existence. Therefore, we offer our humble obeisances unto such a spiritual master. We are indeed very blessed. And knowing that we are very blessed, our gratitude should be endless, infinite, every moment. And that can be shown by trying our very best to do what Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do, namely, to serve Krishna, love Krishna, flood Krishna with whatever love we have through the devotional service that we are given. Those of you who are cooks will cook better. Those of you who are deity dressers will dress the deities better. Those of you who are floor sweepers will sweep better. Why? Because we'll be thinking of Krishna while we do the service. And if we think of Krishna and beg for his mercy, that we may do it better and better because he is the supreme ability, then we will. Because lovingly, he loves to reciprocate with his devotees. Thank you all very much for your listening. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. It's not over. I do have a Ramdas. He disappeared from this world a number of years ago. A very, very great devotee and friend of mine. Friend of many persons sitting here. And I want to read a few things about Ramdas, which are truly show. Savas has given me this. Did you write this, Savas? Okay. Okay. Whoever wrote it is very, very beautiful. So I beg you all to please stay to listen. Ramdas was a great, wonderful devotee, a personality of personalities, stood out and left his body some time ago. And I just want to emphasize, this is the beauty of personalistic yoga. In the impersonalist, a person dies and they think, well, he's just some great soul. He just melted into the light. So I am him, he is I am he, and he is I. So we don't have to glorify him. We don't have to remember him because I'm him and he's me. So what difference does it make? But in personalism, we look up to everyone's activities as minute reflections of the Lord. And then when we see those wonderful reflections, we like to apprehend them. We like to grasp them. We like to hold on to them so that they can be a goad, a stimulus, a means by which we can achieve and acquire those very same qualities. Before I begin to read it, are there any questions or comments that any of us here would like to make before I move on? Please don't be shy. No one will be thought of as stupid if you ask even a stupid question. Everyone is welcome here, and if you're in this room, that shows you're very intelligent, because you're standing in front of the Supreme Lord, and there is no more intelligent thing to do than that in your entire life. Okay, then shall I start the reading? There are no comments? No? Okay. It will take only about, I'd say, 5 minutes, so please bear with me. But it is pure nectar. Remembering Ramdas, the second Sunday of December. After the third day of a devotee's departure from this world, there is this Smrit Sambra ceremony. That is when we remember our association with a god brother who has just departed from this world. In the case of Ramdas Prabhu, many devotees spoke at this ceremony held in Vrindavan in the year of 2000. The information in this paper is a summary of this speaking. It is significant that Ramdas Prabhu left this world during the auspicious days when the moon is waxing between Ekadashi and Purnima, in the very auspicious month of December. Srila Prabhupada said that Vrindavan is a place for taking birth and a place for what? Dying, yes. To show us by his example, Srila Prabhupada left this world from Vrindavan when Ramdas came to know that his time was up. When the doctors told him he did not have much longer, he set his heart on leaving this world from Vrindavan Dham. There is a saying that there are three types of Vrajabasis. A Vrajabasi is one who lives in Vrindavan and worships Krishna and Radha, especially Radha. One who is born in Vrindavan, one who lives in Vrindavan, and one who dies in Vrindavan. The one who dies in Vrindavan is the real Vrijabhasi. To understand how Ram Das could have the kind of conviction to be able to do this, we have to look at his life in Krishna consciousness. Ram Das was a very steady, determined servant of Sri Sri Rukmini Dwarkadish, Gaur Nithai, Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra. Additionally, he was a devoted servant of the servants of the deities. He was always available, always on call for whatever service needed to be performed. He was not much disturbed if a devotee said they would perform an artic and then didn't show up. He would just cover for them. He was very fixed on keeping the exact high standard of service that Srila Prabhupada instituted. He was very devoted to Srila Prabhupada. And yes, he was in anxiety a lot, because devotees some quite often didn't show up for their tasks. But that was a good type of anxiety. It was for Krishna. He wanted Krishna to get the best. And if devotees manifested what they call short shrift, indifference, that disturbed Ram Das. Ram Das was born in Philadelphia and spent 20 years of his life there. He spent his next 20 years in New York City. One day he hitchhiked across the country with only a few dollars in his pocket, with an idea of settling at a Rosicrucian farm in California. In 1980 he arrived in California and spent the night in a homeless shelter in downtown Los Angeles. The next day, devotees came to chant in that area. He was attracted to the devotees. They gave him dinner or a dinner card and a Back to Godhead magazine, which he read in the shelter. The next day, with no bus fare, he set out for the temple on foot. He walked the 10 miles, which took him 4 hours to get to the temple here. A devotee named Nithai greeted him and gave him some Maha Prasad. Now, this shows you, those of you who are going out on kirtan, you know, in the streets, here's what can happen and did happen. So we should not think lightly of this important service. When you're out there, you don't know who is hearing and who will become a person like Ram Das. He was in... excuse me. He was invited into an office where he spoke to the temple vice president. He asked him, "Do you like what you see here?" Ram Das said, "Yes, it's wonderful here." The vice president invited Ram Das to stay for 3 days. Ram Das broke down and cried. He was crying because somebody was caring about him. Someone was taking interest in him. And someone was inviting him to a world so different, so unbelievably in contrast to the world he was living in. Ram Das had a personality that was very much like a communications or public relations person. Although he had never held a job as such. Soon he was put to work with Amala Bhakta Das, given the responsibility to open up Sankirtan spots and arrange for permits for Rath Yatra and Janmashtami. I would send him out to different places which we opened up. And if the authorities, such as the police or the groundskeepers or whoever it is, gave him a hard time, then he would get back to me on the phone. And he would get the phone number of the person who gave him a hard time. I was like the legal coordinator. And then I would talk to them, get the spot open so that devotees could then distribute the literatures. At the time, he would dress Gaur Nithai once a week in their night outfit. Then one day, Vatsal Prabhu, the temple president at that time, told him, "We think you'd make a great pujari. I will talk to you about it sometime." And a few minutes later, he returned and said to Ram Das, "You are going to be head pujari." Didn't even have a chance to reject it. In the words of Krishna Kumari, that was his wife, who was married to Ram Dass some years later, the head pujari had just left and the situation was beyond control. There were 100 women to deal with, including Mother Karta, and they were Prabhupada disciples. Ram Dass wasn't a Prabhupada disciple. And some of them could be very overbearing ladies. There were 100 of them, and they couldn't find anyone to manage them. The problem was not with the service or the cooking and offerings. The problem was with the 100 ladies. So they thought, here is a man who is mild-mannered and a bit older than everyone else. So Ram Dass was asked to fill the position. He took the attitude that the women were already trained and dedicated and more qualified than himself. So he asked them to tell him what to do. Now, that's a very interesting personality trait. He asked those whom he's asked to manage, he asked them, how shall I manage you? Can you imagine somebody says to you, well, how do you want me to manage you? So immediately he's giving them high respect and respecting their needs and their attitudes. There was an initial meeting between Ram Dass and several of the most qualified deity dressers and seamstresses, and together they agreed upon standards for the way the deities should be dressed. Ram Dass became particular about that. Every day he would look over all the dressing that had been done just before the doors were to be opened at 7 a.m. to inspect to see if anything was out of place, missing, or not in keeping with the standard way the deity should appear. For example, he would make sure there was no flute. If Krishna is standing like this, he would make sure there was a flute in his hand, because some deity dresser may just space out and forget to put his flute in his hand. Things like that. Though particular about standards, Ram Dass dealt with all the pujaris in a very loving and personal way. He would tell us repeatedly, just remember, Krishna loves you. Devotees always had good feelings about him. There were always people in and out of his apartment who wanted to see him, either for herbs — he studied medicinal herbs and prescribed different uses for them — or for help with their personal problems. He seemed somehow magically connected to herbal formulas. But perhaps more important than the herbs he prescribed was his — anybody remember? His kindness. He was always ready to hear devotees out and spend his time to preaching to them. He was very approachable. So sometimes he only got 2 hours sleep, sometimes three. And in order to get away, to get his rounds done, he would drive over to the beach and do his chanting there often. He loved to read Prabhupada's books, and he could recite verbatim. Some of the long sets of prayers found in Srimad Bhagavatam. On the temple altar, when he said the standard puja mantras, he would recite them in Sanskrit and then over again in English. He used to say that he couldn't see any point in praying if he didn't know the meaning of what he was saying. His recitation was rhythmic and poetic. Mother Karta said, quote, "One of the visions I always have of him is at the site of the Ratha Yatra. He would carry the deities up to the stage during Ratha Yatra himself. He wouldn't let anyone else carry the deities. He would also get permits for the festival. The limousine people he got to transport the deities would be amazed by Ram Dass's enthusiasm, and they would ask him, 'Who is this person whom we are going to transport?'" Because they're just seeing a wooden face there with big eyes, you know. They can't figure it out. Why all the big to-do about this? Whatever it took, he would always have... He would explain to them, "Well, he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead." He would explain as much as they wanted to hear. Every year, Ram Dass would spend 1 month in India shopping for the deities. He would buy only the most first-class things he could find, the best in dresses, scented oil, incense. He was a nature fanatic, and he had to have everything natural for their lordships, which was more expensive, but he didn't care. Whatever it took, he would always have to get the best for the deities. He often purchased special, small, farm-grown vegetables and natural sugar. Ram Dass had very big hands. He was a tall, large man. His picture is over there, you see. He carried a set of many keys, which was so big and heavy that you could not help but wonder how anyone could remember which key went where. He often had a cloth bag with him, and it was full of sweets. He took it shopping, and he gave a sweet to anyone he did business with, or he gave them a card and invited them to the temple. He was big, and he did everything in a big way. He made big pieces of burfi, para, and sandesh for Rukmini Dwarkadish, and he often passed them out to devotees. In fact, he used to have this sweet store we set up that went on for a few years. It was called the Maha Store, and he had loaded with sweets and sandesh. There was no one who could make sandesh like Ram Dass. He used to give the brahmacharis he was big, and he did everything in a big way. All right. He used to give the brahmacharis a strong hug, as if he would not let them go, and then he would finally let them go if they would do what? Chant Hare Krishna. That was the only way they could escape. He had a great deal of affection and attachment for protecting the deities as well as the devotees. He went on as head pujari like that for 15 years. He seemed to actually understand that serving the Vaishnavas is the key to spiritual life. He once said, "Every single person that comes to me, I will give them my full attention and speak to them. At that moment, they are the most important person then and there." This is personalism. And when we interact with each other, we should try to emulate this and develop this same attitude. When the 1994 earthquake took place, he personally arranged for the deity's worship, which went on temporarily in a bus while the temple was cleaned and restored. Ram Dass was often on a marathon to meet with devotees, to do the deity shopping, as well as to cover services that needed to be covered. It was well known around the temple that if Ram Dass came home and drove into his parking space and dozed off, you should just leave him alone there so he could finally get 1 or 2 hours of sleep. And then on to the next day. Ram Dass had a serious heart attack in 1995. He was diagnosed with dilated cardiomyopathy. In the hospital, the doctor said his heart was enlarged. Well, he had so much love in it, how could it be otherwise? 3 times bigger than normal. According to Mother Karta, quote, "When we were told he had a heart attack, we all thought, oh no, not Ram Dass, not now. And when the doctor said his heart was 3 times enlarged, we thought, so what's new? We already knew this. His heart being large has nothing to do with the heart attack. That is just the way. That is just the way he is." In the hospital, he was in a little bed, and he didn't fit in the bed because he was such a large person. He said, "In this situation, I'm just trying to accept whatever Krishna has given me. If he decides to take me, it is wonderful. Whatever needs to be done, I will do." Virabhahu Prabhu came to the hospital and read out loud to Ram Dass from Chaitanya Charitamrita. The doctor heard the reading when he came to check on Ram Dass, and he asked a question. Ram Dass sat up and started preaching to the doctor. This was typical of Ram Dass. Forgot his ailment, forgot his heart problem, forgot all this. The number one problem at that moment was to give Krishna consciousness to the doctor. This was typical of Ram Dass, yet at this time he was in intensive care, and no one could believe that he had the strength or awareness to sit up and preach so much. Almost finished. The doctor was even more surprised because he had just diagnosed Ram Dass as having only a few more hours to live. Ram Dass gradually recovered enough to come home from the hospital, but the doctors said his heart condition would become worse any time. He rested for 1.5 years, and then he and his wife Krishna Kumari gathered up a few belongings and flew off to India to stay in Vrindavan. When he was there, he used to say, "Krishna has given me some borrowed time." Ram Dass spent his last 3 years in Vrindavan. During that time, he mostly read and chanted and listened to lectures. He did some deity worship in his ashram. He did not engage in idle gossip. If you talked to him about anything at all, he would always relate whatever you said to Krishna and Srila Prabhupada. He became aware that time was getting short and that every moment must be used in the loving service of Krishna. And he wanted to have Krishna on his mind, Prabhupada on his mind, at the very last moment. And that's the way it's done. You keep Prabhupada and Krishna in the center of your conversation. If you talked to him about anything at all, he would always relate it to Krishna and Prabhupada. He became very attached to Srila Prabhupada, and he had many copies of a drawing of Prabhupada's lotus feet laminated or framed to distribute to devotees and worship. Sharing, not just keeping. In his room in Vrindavan, he also kept many beautiful pictures of Sri Sri Rukmini Dwarkadish, whom he had lovingly served without hesitation for so many years. Krishna Kumari did a wonderful, very devoted service by taking care of Ram Dass during those last days. She took care of his body, making sure he always had clean cloth and the special diet and medicine he required. Ram Dass was not at all agreeable to taking the Western medicine that was prescribed for him. The doctor said he should not unnecessarily use up his energy getting out of bed in order to circumambulate a Govardhan Shila. For those who may not know that, it's a stone that comes from Govardhan Hill. But it's not just a stone. It's none different from Krishna. And to read, but Ram Dass said, "Save energy for what? I can't do anything else." I remember, Krishna Kumari explains, "I remember at one point I started to panic." And he could see that, so he decided, as he usually did, to tell me to leave the room because he wanted to be alone. He was very alert and conscious. I left, but I came back and I said, "Ram, Prabhupada is here and everything is all right." He had the laminated picture of Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet upon his heart. He said, "Krishna, Krishna." And he turned to a picture of Srila Prabhupada. His soul left as we were both chanting. Kavichandra Maharaj was with Ram Dass on the day that he left his body. They were laughing and joking together. Ram Dass was very weak but happy. Maharaj gave him his usual treatment, a massage. Of Ram Dass, Maharaj said, "One cannot find fault with him. He was never scrambling for some position or any of those things. He was always blissfully serving Krishna. If we selflessly serve Krishna, that's the result. He will reciprocate and give us everything." Ram Dass reminds us that we can dig down deep to think of all the good qualities of someone. This isn't very hard in his case. He always wanted us to see the solutions and not dwell on the problems. Sometimes our problems are quite complex. Ram Dass exhibited the solutions by surrendering to Krishna. And Krishna kindly took care of him and arranged for everything. Quote, "I thank Ram Dass for his example," this is Kavichandra Dass, "and I thank Krishna Kumara for taking care of him. The day he was brought to the hospital in Los Angeles, they were doubtful that he would make it through the day. They said he would not live without a heart transplant, but they didn't know his heart. They only knew the heart muscle. He was determined, but that was simply for Krishna's pleasure and not for any other reason. When Ram Das's body was brought outside to be carried to the cremation, there was a white cow standing on the right side of the gate. And that is considered an auspicious, favorable omen. When Radharani goes out of her house every day to go and play with Krishna, if she sees a white cow on the right, then she knows she will see Krishna that day. Ram Das's body was so heavy that the men who carried the palanquin struggled under the weight of it. At the burning ghat, there was another struggle to supply enough wood to the fire. There was such a loud kirtan and large procession of devotees following as they carried Ram Das's body to the Yamuna, that person standing in the bazaar asked, "Is that the guru?" And the devotees replied, "Yes, that is the guru. All glories to Ram Das Prabhu ki. All glories to Ram Das Prabhu ki. All glories to Ram Das Prabhu ki. Hare Krishna. Glories to Prabhupada ki." Thank you all so much for being attentive.